Michael, thank you, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very grateful that Michael and you all have invited me to share some thoughts today on world affairs. Not that there's much going on these days in London or Washington. Placid time. And you probably note from the title that I gave Michael when he said, we must have a title for your lecture. I made it fairly general, changing global order, so we can go anywhere we like with that framework of conversation. And I do look forward to getting your thoughts, and I'll be happy to answer any questions and share with you at least my perspective on not just a world order, a changing world order, but I know specifically you might have some interest in what's going on in Washington, not that you're not unaware of generally what's going on, but probably more to the point, where's all this leading? And I know you're asking the same questions here in London about the UK and a number of Western democracies around the world, as well as I think all regions of the world are in some state of volatility. And I would even say more significant than that, real danger, because when the world starts to fray and go in different directions and there is very little order, things become particularly volatile and unsettled and uncertain, unstable, and dangerous. We've not seen this world in this state of affairs since World War II. Every region of the world is in some difficulty. I mean, the Middle East probably with the most significant focus, where there's really no good news, and it's as dangerously unsettled as I think we've ever seen it. But coming back to Washington and London, it's been a while since we've seen such unsettled times in our capitals, as well as uncertainty in the Canadian election. It appears that Mr. Trudeau has held on, but he's going to have to form a coalition government. We're seeing coalitions governments across Europe. Mrs. Merkel will be leaving soon. Asia-Pacific, no different dynamics, different frameworks, different governments, different challenges, but still very uncertain, whether it's North Korea and the differences that are becoming more and more obvious between South Korea and Japan, which is not good news. Trade, tariffs, sanctions, all now woven into the same fabric of a world order, a world order that we all, particularly the United States and British and other nations, came together in building after World War II, the 10-year period after World War II. And let me begin my remarks with starting there, because I think in order to have any understanding or appreciation of where we are today, I think it's important we all step back and review a bit where we came from, how we got here, and what's this so-called liberal world order that we hear about that's being challenged today everywhere by nationalism, populism, a questioning of these institutions that were built in the construction of that world order, institutions that I often refer to as coalitions of common interest, because the world order that we saw built after World War II was based on primarily the common interest of all people. It was never intended to be the perfect order, nor could it be, solve all the problems, nor could it. But a world order that was built around institutions that shared the same values of common interest, of trade, of prosperity, of improvement, all disciplines of the world, science, technology, freedom, democratic reform, individual rights. Those are in the interest of every people in and on every continent. So as we review all those institutions, the United Nations, Collective Security, NATO, IMF, World Bank, that came from the Bretton Woods 1944 conference, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which as we all know is the WTO now, dozens of multilateral development institutions and banks, all encouraging more commerce, more understanding, more ventures to understand each other, held the world together pretty well for 70 years. And I would be so bold as to say, if we had not had those institutions, I'm not sure as complicated and difficult as the world is today, and that period that we're going through, I'm not sure we'd be in as strong and good a position today if we would have had no institutions over the last 70 years. We have had no World War III. I think of the continent of Europe and the UK. The United States was spared from World War I and World War II. I mean, we had men and women who lost their lives. But we didn't see the devastation on our land and what happened to people's economies, devastated in World War II especially. The mass slaughter of millions and millions of people that resulted from those two world wars. So the first 50 years, the 20th century, were not good, were good years. So 70 years that we've lived with this new world order have produced no World War III, no nuclear exchange, more freedom for more people than any other time in the history of man, more prosperity for more people, more opportunities, more advances in every discipline and technology. With all the problems and all the failures, we still have done pretty well. And so, as history informs us, you go through these periods every so often, 50, 60, 70 years, when there is a general questioning of the current status of affairs, not just sovereign nation affairs, but world affairs, but because we are all global citizens. Yes, we're citizens of our sovereign nations, but we're global citizens. We're not going to unwind that and undo that. We are connected to everything. A world commerce, world trade, world security. Start really with the fundamentals of climate and clean air and clean water and clean oceans, and then work from there. So as I begin working my way through this to share some thoughts, I want to go to a book that many of you have read and certainly are familiar with it, because the British are very prominent in this book. And it's the former Secretary of State Dean Acheson's book that he wrote after he left office as Secretary of State. During that time, he was one of the global architects of the world order, called President at the Creation. I had read that book years ago, but I've just recently read it again when I've had a little more time on my hands. And it does take you back and remind you clearly of what it took to build this order and how it wasn't easy to get the French and the Germans after World War II to agree on anything, and how the British played such a role in that effort. All the people that you know, Anthony Eden, Clement Attlee, Churchill, all giants of the architecture, how important Konrad Adenauer was to working with Schumann and other French leaders to make things happen. It wasn't just as if this new world order of prosperity dropped out of the heavens. It was tough as hell for 10 years, and it was uncertain. NATO was uncertain. So much was uncertain. Now it's being questioned. Well, it's being questioned in some terms, some ways, and timely, that's natural, that, as I mentioned, comes every 50, 60, 70 years in cycles. And to take you back to that, I'm going to quote from Abraham Lincoln something he said in 1862, and this is in Dean Acheson's book, because I think it sets the framework of what we're talking about this afternoon, and the framework of the reality that we're experiencing today in the world. And he said this in a cabinet meeting in 1862 when, and you know the history of America, we were going through the Civil War. And a number of his cabinet members and others in the Congress said, why don't we just let the South split off, the North split off, we'll divide the country, we'll have two different countries, and everybody will be happy. And that was a pretty prevailing thought at the time. I wasn't there, but I've read a little bit about it. And so Abraham Lincoln listened intently to all the points of view, and then he said that I think it particularly pertinent to our times. He said this, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion and find new adjustments, new adaptations. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew, but hold true to the foundations that built our country and our society. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." I've read this over more and more, and the more I read it, the more it really does, in my opinion, explain a lot of where the world is today. The legitimate questioning of institutions. I think you here in the UK are about one of those issues as much as anything, but I think it's more than just membership in the EU. It's what has the EU done for us, what penalties do we pay, regardless of what side you're on. Those are legitimate questions to be asked by a sovereign nation. Is it still relevant to our needs, to our sovereignty? We are a sovereign nation. I'll leave that to you British to figure out. We've got our own issues in Washington. But it's the same thing that's being applied in Germany. You see, however way you want to brand it, nationalism, populism, I suspect most of that or a lot of it's been brought on by the refugees coming out of the Middle East, as much of the populism, nationalism, I think, is a result in Europe of what we're seeing in the Middle East. But every Western democracy is going through some phase of that questioning of those institutions. Has it really helped us? We are going through it in the United States. And I've said about the Trump administration, about President Trump specifically, President Trump was not the cause of what we're going through. He was the consequence. This questioning and not trusting anybody, and that's very much an issue here and all over Europe, mistrust in government, mistrust in leaders. What have you done for us? We can't rely on you. That's aided and abetted, of course, by social media and 24-hour breaking news. We're not going to go unwind all that. You're going to have 24-hour breaking news, I suspect, forever. So what Abraham Lincoln said in his comments is quite relevant, and he made those comments in 1862. You adjust and you adapt to the times. There are new challenges, new realities we must face. And so the institutions that we've relied on for 70 years may need adjustment to be relevant to these times and changes and demands and our sovereign needs. But he also meant you don't throw it all out. You just don't unwind it all and leave it in a heap of trash. Because then what do you have? 7 billion people on the face of the earth floating out there going their own way. Demographers tell us we're going to have 2 billion more people by 2045. Now, if we've got a few problems with 7 billion, I don't think it gets more uncomplicated with 2 billion more. It's more complicated, starting again with the environment and everything else that we're going to address and continue to address in governments, in trade, in relationships, security, intelligence sharing, and sharing, police sharing. Terrorism's not new. It's just more sophisticated. Terrorism's been around since man, and it's going to continue. Because of technology, it has given non-state actors now tremendous opportunities and advantages that they never had. And they brought terrorism to a new sophistication of slaughter and intimidation and killing. No one nation is capable, not the United States, the UK, any one nation is capable of dealing with that alone. And one of the great strengths in alliances, certainly I saw it firsthand as Secretary of Defense of the United States, is the strength alliances bring when you combine the interests of intelligence sharing with allies, your defense, the projection of American power is directly a result of alliances. Now, we have the biggest military, most sophisticated military in the world, but to project that, we wouldn't be able to project that without the allies allowing us bases around the world where we could put our rotation or permanent bases, men and women, where we'd have landing rights for maintenance of our planes and port calls and harbors for our ships, keeping those sea lanes free. The British are part of that in NATO as other NATO nations. But alliances bring a tremendous amount to a sovereign nation. And I've always been mystified in our current president's position on this, as he has suggested that I guess his foreign policy is America first. I mean, that's not a foreign policy, but he announced it again at the United Nations last month, that we essentially don't need the rest of the world. The rest of the world have been freeloaders and taken advantage of us. Well, someone who served a number of years in the United States Senate, I've also built companies, international companies, and been all over the world as a businessman, as a senator on the Foreign Relations Committee and the Intelligence Committee, as chairman of President Obama's Intelligence Advisory Board. I was in the Reagan administration. I worked for President H.W. Bush, then as Secretary of Defense. I've seen firsthand the critical relationships and what they bring to nations through these alliances. And they're imperfect. They need to be adjusted, yes. But without them, the world would be a whole different place, and it would be much more dangerous. I want to continue along the line of Washington, since I know a lot more about Washington politics than the UK politics or any other. But I do pay attention, and I've had wonderful relationships that I've been able to renew the last couple of days I've been here in London with former defense ministers of yours and foreign ministers, ministers of the Exchequer, my old friend Michael, not that he's old, but he's a friend that I've known a long time. And it just is a refreshing and renewing for me as an American to hear from these men and women that I've worked with over the years, whom I have great respect for, and your country and your government, who also say give me their understanding and appreciation of allies and relationships, because it's like a community, it's like a society. it's built on relationships. And relationships don't determine how a sovereign nation will respond, because every sovereign nation always responds in its own self-interest. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's predictable. You know that. But responsible relationships, relationships that have respect for each other, that understand each other, that's a special glue that holds an architecture of different nations together and relationships together. And it binds people. Even though you will always respond in your interest, the U.S. will respond. But in between, there are so many more common interests that we have with the United States, with Britain, with Asians, than different interests. It's always been that way. And again, that's how this world order was built, and on the framework of that, and sustaining that thinking in those 10 years after World War II. In Washington today, we're going through as chaotic a period as I've seen in my lifetimes. I wasn't around for all of it, but I can tell you when I first came out of Vietnam, I came back. I was in Vietnam all of 1968 with my brother, who served side by side with me. He started college. I finished college. My educational career, Lord Lothian, was not one to be emulated. I had gone to 4 colleges before I got out of any of them. One was generous and just let me out. It was probably in everyone's best interest. But I went to Washington in 1972 looking for a job. And I became the chief of staff to a Nebraska congressman I went in 71 looking for a job, became his chief of staff at the end of 1972. I tell you that because I was there at the front end and during the Watergate mess. And I worked for a Republican, so I recall Gerry Ford coming in and out of his office and all the players that you all know from history, and some of you probably knew Gerry Ford, as fine and decent a man and leader as I've ever known. But I saw all of that. I had a front row seat. I mean, I was just a kid and knew nothing, but I knew enough to pay attention to what was going on. As bad as that was, when Nixon left office in 1974 and the impeachment process had started, as you know, the articles of impeachment had been voted on in the Judiciary Committee of the House, but he resigned before the full House impeached him. I never ever lost track of what I learned during that time. Roll forward to 1998. I was a United States Senator. Bill Clinton was impeached. So I sat as a juror in the Senate, and that's the role of the United States Senate during impeachment. The role of the House of Representatives is much like a grand jury. And it isn't to convict or exonerate. We think there's enough here, it should go to trial. The trial then goes to the Senate. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides in the Senate, and we have a trial, and both sides present evidence. So I watched that, and I go back to my Watergate times, the Clinton times, and how all that happened. What started it? What perpetuated then the first question? And there's always a pulling of the string, and there's always another string that's pulled that starts to unwind something. And it unwinds and unwinds and unwinds. That's what's going on in Washington today. It's normally a fairly slow process. It's a painful process because it consumes the entire nation. Not, I suspect, unlike what Brexit has done to the UK. And that means the government has very little time to focus on other issues. And that's very dangerous in a world like we are living in today. Very dangerous. And so that's the biggest concern I have in my capital, in my country, and it's going to get worse as this administration becomes deeper and deeper and more consumed with trying to salvage itself protect the president, and where does this go from here? Again, our situations are not exactly analogous, what you're going through here, what we're going through in Washington, but there are some similarities, and one being the government's time is distracted and energy and taken away from what you should be focused on, which we should all be focused on, the big issues of our time. We're going to continue, unfortunately, with this certainly for the next 13 months in Washington. We have a presidential election in November. We have one-third of the United States Senate that will be elected or reelected. The entire House of Representatives is up for reelection. A large percentage of governors across the United States. So next year's election represents a big, big year of voting. This is going to be right at the tail end of the impeachment process, and I suspect, observing this and knowing a little something about it, the president will be impeached by the House. Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, other leaders that are leading the impeachment inquiry now are doing it the right way, if there is a right way on impeachment, methodically, step by step, and that's the way it must be done, not to rush to anything, to see if there is enough there to indict, meaning putting together articles of impeachment, which will be voted on one by one. One could be obstruction of justice. One could be perjury. I mean, I don't know. I don't think they're there yet. But it's a process. It's day by day, week by week. And if you've been following our week in Washington this week, today begins a week-long number of major, very significant witnesses who were all in the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine during the so-called phone conversations and the meetings and so on and so on. This is most likely not going to come out well for the president in what these people have to say. Next week, it will be followed by another series of witnesses coming before the House Intelligence Committee, which is the main committee that is leading this impeachment inquiry. Something else I learned about that process during Watergate and during Bill Clinton's is there are always surprises. And I used to tell my Senate staff and all the different staffs I've had over the years and with the Reagan administration when I was at Department of Defense, don't ever think that you're getting away with anything. There are no secrets in Washington. And I suspect there are no secrets in London. There are no secrets in Washington. And you might get away with something for a while. But when a process like this starts, a lot of people are shaking in their boots because they don't know if the string's going to be pulled next on what they know or what they did or what they were party to. It makes everybody uneasy. And it also, what it does, it produces, not all at once, because people want to kind of see where this is going, but once a decision is made that this is serious and this is going forward, it produces, as we say in our country, a coming to Jesus meeting. You want to get right with the world very quickly. And that means that you abandon the president very quickly if you know anything. And it happened, Watergate, it happened during Clinton administration. And out of all that comes a number of things that you didn't anticipate, that you didn't think about, you didn't know. And I suspect we're going to have the same kind of thing in Washington. So on the political scene, that's generally our state of affairs, that we're going to be living through that and consumed by that for the next 13 months until we have a new election in November. Who the candidates are, we still don't know. Certainly on the Democratic side, the Democrats won't start voting in their primaries until early February. The two leading and continuing leading candidates are Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. That probably doesn't change. But when you look at polls, and after now three debates, and after a few months of this, where you start to see kind of things breaking out in the clear. Most, other than Bernie Sanders, most everybody else is way, way down here in the basement in polling numbers. That doesn't mean it can't change. It means it's happened in our system many times that a candidate comes out of nowhere and wins Iowa. I mean, that Barack Obama was a good example of that. Hillary Clinton in 2008 was odds-on favorite to be the Democratic nominee for president. And pretty much everybody thought she had it sewed up. Barack Obama upset her, beat her in Iowa, and that just took all the momentum away from her and gave it to Obama. Then, you know, the rest is history. Jimmy Carter in 1976, this southern governor that no one had ever heard of. Who is he? That's a joke. He wins Iowa and becomes the nominee. So there are a lot of things that can happen yet in this process and will. On the Republican side, I think it's still very unclear whether Trump is the nominee for president. That's going to obviously depend on impeachment. If he's impeached but not found guilty in the Senate, and right now that would be a tall order because the Democrats would need 20 Republican senators. They need 67 out of 100 to convict. But we're at the front end, and you've seen a few of these Republican senators kind of tiptoe away a little bit, say, well, show me the evidence. I mean, if the evidence is there, we're probably going to have to do something. So they're kind of hedging their bets on this. So we're a long way from knowing who's up, who's down. A lot of scenarios can be written. Maybe Mike Pence is the nominee. Maybe Trump is impeached and convicted. Maybe he's impeached but not convicted, and he resigns. I mean, Pence may be implicated in some of this. So you just don't know. Well, not to spend a lot of time on that political dynamic in Washington, but it affects what I was talking about earlier, global affairs, because I've always believed, and I don't mean this to sound arrogant at all from an American, but because we have played in the last 70 years such an important role in the world. We haven't played the central role, but we've played a very important role with our allies. When America is off balance, the world's off balance. Because when you can't rely on America's word, you may agree or disagree, and you can't trust America's word, and our credibility, for example, with NATO allies, would we come to the defense of Eastern Europe, those Baltic countries, for example, if Putin would decide to roll in 10 divisions of tanks, what would we do? Well, you all know the rules of NATO. An attack on one, attack on all. But with President Trump, I don't know. He's made it uncertain. That has to reflect on the thinking in each of the capitals of NATO countries. How much can we count on the United States? It certainly is in Asia when President Trump pulled America out of the TPP trade relationship, which I think was one of the biggest mistakes we've made, opened the door to China. And I've had Chinese counterparts who were foreign ministers, defense ministers, all the ambassadors from the Asia-Pacific countries say to me, Mr. Secretary, we don't have any choice now but to accommodate, to make some accommodations. Well, what they're saying, it makes some accommodations to China. And by the way, I'm not one who believes that the answer to China for the United States or the world is to do everything we can to keep China down or push them backward. I think that's folly. That never works. That's not the approach. You use statecraft. You use leadership. You use allies. You use common interests to deal with China or Russia. Not America first. The strength America brings is our alliances. I said to somebody the other day, who are China's allies? Nobody. Who are Russia's allies? We so, I think, understate and undervalue the strength of alliances, friendships, that it's dangerous. And I think that's part of what we're going through now in the world. Do we really need each other? Do we really need these institutions, as imperfect as they are, and they're constantly requiring maintenance to assure that they're addressing the problems of all of us, of all of our citizens in each of our countries. The United States has come up with some economic numbers the last week about prosperity in our country. When you start breaking down prosperity across the board in any of our countries, median income, average income, well, you got to be careful with those numbers because, you know, numbers can make, you can make about any point you want with numbers. Depend on how you frame it and how you cast it and so on. We've had some difficulties in our country. And I can understand, going back to the comment I made about Trump being the consequence, not the cause of what happened. I think that's, at least in my mind, an important point to remember because Trump represented something new in 2016. Americans were not happy. We had gotten ourselves into senseless wars in the Middle East, at least in my opinion. We helped bring on the biggest economic catastrophe since the Great Depression in 2008 and 2009 that affected everybody. Surely affected us. We saw a balanced budget that President George W. Bush inherited in 2001 from Bill Clinton, completely squandered. And it took President George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, down in defeat. That's why he lost that election in 1992 to Bill Clinton, because he went back on a promise of, read my lips, no new taxes. But he did the right thing for the country, and he knew it was at his peril. And he was defeated because of that economic issue. American presidential elections are rarely, rarely, if ever, settled on foreign policy issues. Because we don't think that way. Because why do we? Why would we have to? We're the biggest, most powerful country on earth. And everybody has to respond to us. So that's the way a lot of voters in America have viewed elections over the years. It's not foreign policy. It's economic issues. That's the bottom line. And so when you look at the divisions in America, as we are seeing more people fall below certain lines, and people on top increase their wealth. So we're seeing that separation widen. You're going to have an issue, just like what's happening in Lebanon today, just like what's happening in Chile today, in Spain today. I mean, everywhere you look around the world, nationalism, populism, or any way you want to frame it or say it, a lot of people feel that they have been left behind. And our politicians and leaders have failed. So Trump comes along in 2016. I haven't been part of the problem. I mean, my strongest point to offer you, American voters, is that I know nothing about the job of President of the United States, so vote for me, because I haven't been part of the problem. And because I'm a billionaire, successful, he said businessman, but he's not a businessman, real estate huckster, and that's, you should vote for me, because look at Hillary Clinton, her pedigree. I mean, she represents the elite political classes who've got this country in all kinds of trouble. Well, Hillary's campaign was probably the worst I've ever seen run, presidential campaign. She was not a good candidate. I mean, everything was just right for Donald Trump. So, I mean, I talked to a lot of people across the country in 2016, and their attitude was, well, you know, I don't like a lot of the stuff that's come out on Trump, and his mannerisms, what he said about women, and so on, but hey, we're not electing St. Francis here, and I'm willing to give him a try. Well, in American politics, I've always had a theory, and I think it's generally been borne out, not because it's any special, profound theory I have, but the American people will give a president about 3 years. And I think generally that way in all democracies of your leaders. It's about a 3 year. By the end of the third year, the American people have made a decision on the president. And it's not probably going to change in a re-election. And it's just like day and night, and it happens. And we gave him a chance. He's not done as well as we thought, or he's done better than we thought, or he's done terrible. And they make a decision, and that's it. So as you see this impeachment process go forward, it's accelerating probably Trump's, or let me put it this way, voters' views of him. I mean, the polls show it, too. I mean, polls are polls, so, I mean, they're one indication, but you are always mindful of problems with polls. And I'm gonna get there, Michael. And so, again, I know I've thrown a lot out there, and I know the title of what I was going to talk about is so general that we could have talked about movies, but I think you've got so much on your mind, and probably you want to talk about what you want to talk about, and I'm very happy to understand what you're talking about and thinking about in particular. So, again, if I meandered around too much, I apologize, but I am a former U.S. senator, so I pick up bad habits that I haven't gotten rid of. So, again, thank you very much.